You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig and Teamsters Local 41. Blake and Ulig, associates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. We thank our underwriters for their support to KKFI and the Heartland Labor Forum. On tonight's show, much has been written about the Trump tax cuts and their effects on the federal budget, as well as on the economy. But what is less known is how these tax changes have affected the budgets of our states, whose tax laws are expected to stay in sync with the federal ones. Join us on the Heartland Labor Forum, well, join us tonight, as we talk to the Missouri Budget Project and the Kansas Center for Economic Growth about the issues state lawmakers are dealing with to balance this year's budgets. In the news, another teacher strike today. This one's in Sacramento. And Bernie Sanders wants a federal repeal of right to work. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel, and it's about, she asks, what's a hiring haul? Now for the news.
Strike again today, this time in Sacramento, where 3,000 members of the Sacramento City Classroom Teachers Association, for the first time in 30 years, are walking on picket lines outside their schools. The strike by SCTA members has major ramifications for Los Angeles, Oakland, and Denver, along with other cities and districts where agreements were reached after recent strikes or hard bargaining. Educators in Sacramento actually have a contract, which their superintendent, Jorge Aguilar, signed under threat of a strike 16 months ago. Now Aguilar is refusing to honor the contract, so teachers have walked out on an unfair labor practice strike. In that contract, educators agreed to change in their health plans, which would save the school district $16 million, which would be used to reduce class sizes and improve services to students. In addition, the school district was strongly advised to reduce an additional, what was termed bureaucratic bloat, of $15.6 million in cost. But instead of chopping from the top, according to the union, Superintendent Aguilar went on a spending spree that included adding more administrators and an outrageous $6 million vacation buyout to the top administrators. Some managers received six-figure payouts. Now the union believes the district is in violation of California law by refusing to honor the terms of their collective bargaining agreement.
Senator Bernie Sanders keeps heading where no one else has gone, at least recently. This time, he even outstripped the AFL-CIO by calling for a ban on right-to-work laws. On April 8th, Sanders spoke at a machinist transportation conference in Las Vegas and said, under the most significant labor legislation introduced in a very, very long time, we will end once and for all the disastrous right-to-work in 28 states. Sanders also said right-to-work ban would include curbing company misclassification of workers as independent contractors. Legally, independent contractors can't organize, aren't covered by labor laws, including minimum wage and overtime laws, unemployment insurance, and workman's comp. The independent contractors must also pay their own Social Security and Medicare payroll taxes, both as employers and employees. Sanders said that by misclassifying workers, employers are ruthlessly exploiting their employees by misclassifying them as independent contractors and denying them overtime by calling them supervisors. Even a labor reform bill backed by the AFL-CIO does not call for repeal of right to work. However, from 1947, when it was enacted as part of the infamous Taft-Hartley Law, until 1965, repeal was a strident part of all labor platforms. Sanders introduced right-to-work repeal last year in Congress, but it went nowhere. GOP control of the U.S. Senate makes its prospects uncertain in Congress, too. The repeal of right-to-work was endorsed by other candidates at the Building Trades Workers Meeting, including Senators Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Amy Klobuchar.
Last week, we reported on Equal Pay Day, the day usually in April when women earn as much since January of the previous years as men did in the previous December 31st. It's said that women earn 79 or 80 cents for every man's dollar, but that may understate the real pay gap. For many women of color, the gap is much greater. For instance, black women make up about 61 cents in the dollar compared with men, while Latino women make 53 cents for every dollar that a man makes. But it's actually worse than any of these numbers would suggest, according to a 2018 report by the Institute for Women's Policy Research, IWPR, a think tank that looks at public policy through the lens of gender. Measures of the pay gap typically compare the wages of men and women working full-time in a given year, as Emily Peck notes on Huffington Post. But women are more likely to drop out of a full-time work to take care of children or family members. To account for this, the report's authors looked at women's earnings across a 15-year period and compared those with men's. What they found was a pay gap nearly twice as big as what's traditionally reported. Averaging over 15 years, the women made just 49 cents for every dollar men made. Men lost income when they dropped out of the labor force, too, of course. But women are far more likely to drop out, and when they did, the wage penalty was more severe. Those inequalities, the report argues, are key to understanding the wage gap and, ultimately, closing it.
And finally, if fast food workers ever had any doubt about the Trump administration looking out for the interests of their employers, they need look no further than the recent Department of Labor proposal that would limit the ability of workers to sue big companies for violations made by franchises or contractors. This would affect workers who fall under the category of joint employment, in which more than one company directly or indirectly controls their working conditions. The new regulation would make it harder for workers to sue companies like McDonald's for failing to comply with laws like those governing minimum wage or overtime pay. Instead, they'd be forced to sue the individual franchise. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta said in a statement, quote, "This proposal will reduce uncertainty over joint employer status and clarify for workers who is responsible for their employment protections." Whatever Acosta says, the reasons for this rollback are pretty obvious. Clearly, it's harder to extract money from your local franchise for violating your labor rights than it is to get a settlement from an international corporation. This would make big companies happy. In 2016, the Obama administration tried to help franchise workers by implementing regulations that would hold big companies accountable for the violations of their franchisees and contractors. Under the Obama-era regulations, a company like Dunkin' Donuts would be liable for wage theft committed by a franchisee, even if the company didn't directly supervise staff. Providing tools like software or creating policies for the franchisees was enough to prove the company's exerted control over the workplace. Now, Acosta and Trump are veering back in the other direction. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Chuck Weissmiller, Tom Gepkin, Keith Washburn, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. We are 1 year into the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, otherwise known as the Trump Tax Cuts, and the picture of who is benefiting the most is becoming clearer. The still incredibly unpopular tax changes are proving its worst critics true on everything from paying for itself, it's not, improving workers' pay, it's not, boosting the economy, eh, and biggest of all, giving working people an actual tax cut. While the middle class and working poor are seeing at best a few hundred dollars in savings, one-fifth of middle-class taxpayers are actually paying more in taxes. And when you factor in how the changes have affected state tax laws, many paying less on the federal level are now paying more to their state. And none of this includes what will happen to federal programs that many people rely on as the federal deficit skyrockets. Republican leaders have already called for massive cuts to Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, SNAP, the list goes on, in order to balance the federal budget. Even modest cuts to those programs would likely offset the meager savings most people are seeing in their federal taxes. Meanwhile, those at the top of the income distribution and the corporations they own and operate are reaping billions of dollars in windfall. According to the Tax Policy Center, households in the top fifth of income distribution will not only receive the largest boost in after-tax annual income, $7,460 per person, but also the largest percentage increase, 2.3%, as opposed to the 1% gain for households in the bottom three-fifths. And if that weren't shocking enough, the top 1% will see a 2.9% boost in income. That's $61,000 per year. And the top 0.1%, a whopping $252,300 annual increase in after-tax income, or a 2.7% increase, with corporations receiving a 40% cut in their tax rate and working Americans getting only $300 to $400 bump in their take-home pay. It's easy to see how the Trump tax cuts are slamming the accelerator on rising inequality. It's truly a new gilded age. But all this discussion in the media about what is happening at the federal level is overshadowing the very real impacts these tax changes are also having on the revenues and budgets of the states. Most states' tax laws are tied or coupled to the federal tax code in some manner or another, and these states are seeing big cuts in revenues that they never asked for or had any say about. The impacts are unique to each state depending on just how their laws are dependent on the federal code. Tonight, we're going to learn how Missouri and Kansas are dealing with these changes to their budgets brought on by changes at the federal level. Joining us first tonight to talk about the state of Missouri is Lindsay Baker, the research director for the Missouri Budget Project. Ms. Baker, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So there are literally hundreds of changes to the federal tax code. There are two significant ones that directly affect the state of Missouri's budget and the way people file their state income taxes, and that's the new higher standard deduction and the loss of the personal exemption. So Missouri tax law is directly linked to the federal when it comes to those two elements. How are those changes affecting the Missouri tax collections this year?
Right. So the standard deduction is directly linked in Missouri is directly linked to the standard deduction at the federal level. So what that means is that when the federal tax code changed to double the standard deduction, Missouri's standard deduction automatically doubled as well. And that led to about a $700 million loss in revenue in Missouri. Now, that was coupled with other changes that to some extent balance that out. So it doesn't mean automatically a $700 net loss in revenue. And one of the things that that was coupled with was the loss of the personal exemption, which would actually raise revenue in Missouri. Okay, so that kind of balances that out. Mm-hmm. But the difference between the standard deduction, which the tie to the Missouri tax code was very clear on, with a personal exemption, that link to the federal tax code was not as clear. So what that meant was the initial estimates that were produced to determine the impact of those two things on the Missouri tax code were not correct, just because what the personal exemption Missouri statute said was that the personal tax exemption in Missouri is equal to a person is eligible for the personal income tax exemption in Missouri if they are also eligible for the federal income tax exemption. But what happened at the federal level is they didn't actually eliminate the personal exemption. They made it equal to zero. So what that meant is it left Missouri vulnerable to anyone who could have a case saying that the personal exemption still existed in Missouri. So Missouri could potentially have lost about $440 million in revenue due to that.
So you're saying because the personal exemption still existed but was $0 at the federal level, the Missouri state, the Missouri personal exemption, which was, I don't know, $2,000 or $3,000, I'm not sure how much it was, somebody could argue that still should be in place.
That's exactly right. Okay. That's exactly right. And so what happened is, the Missouri Budget Project worked with legislators in the last session to be able to clarify that language. So that protected about $440 billion in revenue. But I would say, those two things were the major pieces that were tied to the federal tax code. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, there were hundreds and hundreds of changes in the tax bill. So I think the larger important point to make about the impact of those federal changes on the state tax code is that we know from experience that legislation that's drafted quickly can often have very unintended and large consequences. And so I think, the takeaway from that is we don't really fully know what the impact of those federal changes is on Missouri revenue collections at this point.
Well, and one of, example of what you're talking about is last month, the director of the Department of Revenue, Joel Walters, resigned over an issue with the state's tax withholding formula. And that's how you determine which taxes are taken out of your check each paycheck over throughout the year. And so this has led to a lot of Missourians having to pay taxes when they file this year or receive much smaller refunds when maybe they were used to getting a refund. So what can you explain what happened here and how is that affecting the current state budget picture?
That's right. So we don't know internally exactly what happened with the formula or what happened internally at the department yet. But what we do know is that Missourians ended up with a surprise tax bill. And that's because across the state, Missourians did not have enough taxes withheld from their paychecks each month. So people who were expecting to have a refund in many cases instead owed the state money. And so at this point, we are about $300 million below where the state expected to be at this point in the year. So we've got about a $300 million gap to make up. In order to make up that gap over the next 3 months, revenue collection would have to increase by about 16%. Now, some of that gap will be closed over the next few months as people pay their taxes. We do know that because people, in many cases, had unexpected owed unexpected taxes, they're holding on to those returns longer than they normally would.
Right. They're waiting until Monday at the filing an extension.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Or filing an extension. So we do know that some of that or a large portion of that will be made up. But the size of the gap indicates that it likely won't be made up entirely. There probably will be some shortfall left. Yeah. But it's very difficult at this point to estimate how much that shortfall might be. And that's particularly problematic right now because next year's budget that the House has already passed relies very heavily on an anticipated carryover from this year's budget, which means that budget assumes that there will be money left over that was not spent this year.
Because Missouri does two-year budgeting, right?
Missouri has a balanced budget, which also means that any carryover needs to be applied to the next year, or any shortfall also gets applied to the next year. And so the budget currently assumes there will be money left over, which can be applied to fiscal year 2020. If there is, in fact, a shortfall, that's going to mean that when the Senate is already debating those bills, As the Senate crafts that legislation, they're going to have to take that into account and potentially make some pretty serious cuts to next year's budget.
Wow. Now, do we think that the Department of Revenue has their tax tables figured out for this year? Are they withholding properly now? Do we know?
I don't think we know that at this point. I think that adjustments are being made. I don't think because this is not – because I think the issue at this point is right now there are – lots of different tax changes that are being implemented at the same time. So while we have a very clear idea of what revenues are being collected, we don't at this point have a very good sense of why those changes are occurring.
Right.
Some of that is because of under withholding, but likely some of it is also because of loopholes that were introduced as part of the federal tax changes and potentially due to simultaneous cuts that are occurring at the state level that were passed in 2014 but triggered last year.
And that brings me to my next question. You know, these budget problems with Missouri are not new. I mean, much has been made of the Kansas tax experiment under Sam Brownback, but few people seem to realize that Missouri has been conducting its own experiment over the past few years. Isn't that right? I mean, this has kind of been a slower glide path to zero.
That's exactly right. So Missouri really has a long simmering budget crisis that's caused by decades of unfair and bad tax policy. So we've had years and years of tax, really decades of tax cuts that were skewed toward the wealthy and corporations. And when you add all of those tax cuts up, they add up to about $1.5 billion every single year in lost revenue. And so what that means is that the Kansas tax cuts, for the most part, were implemented as part of one large tax cut. They happened fast, and people saw the impact of those immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Missouri has really implemented those over a series of several decades, which means that they happen little by little by little. And in part, that means that there have been serious cuts to programs. But more likely, it means that we've just have chronic underfunding of programs.
Right.
And it's much harder to, you don't miss something that you've never had.
Correct.
And so what that means today in Missouri is that our eligibility for many programs is lower even than what Kansas was after their cuts were implemented.
Right. I mean, for example, just to let people understand how severe, Medicaid, like if you do not have a child and you're male, and you can't even qualify for Medicaid, right?
That's correct. So,
and what's the income limit if you do? Like, it's like 5,000. I mean, you can't make more than.
So if you're a parent, so if you're someone who does not have, say, a disability or isn't over a certain age, then you qualify for Medicaid if you make somewhere around $385 a year for a family or a month for a family of three. So it's a very low eligibility.
More than
that's about 22% of the federal poverty line. So it's incredibly restrictive.
Yeah.
And it's not just that. Across the board, when you look at services in Missouri, by almost every measure, Missouri trails the nation. So public health, our state funding is last in the nation. Higher ed, 45th lowest in the nation. K-12, 46th in the nation. Foster care reimbursement rates, almost lowest in the nation. So it's really, across the board, those services have been lacking.
You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and I'm talking with Lindsay Baker from the Missouri Budget Project about the impact of the state's budget from last year's federal tax changes. Let's back to what you're talking about this sort of chronic problem. I mean, going back to just 2014, I guess, was Missouri implemented a tax cut that is getting a lot of press in the federal level now with this, the Trump tax cut law, and that is a 20% deduction for pass-through income or income from businesses such as partnerships, S-corporations, sole proprietorships, that business owners can claim on their individual tax returns. You know, this is not – Kansas, some people will recall, did this a few years ago, and it went to zero. It's not quite that extreme, but can you explain a little bit about what this pass-through income is and how that has affected Missouri's – I understand that was went into effect, that was triggered to go into effect this year.
In 2018, it started to be phased in. So essentially what the pass-through deduction is, you may have also heard it referred to as the LLC loophole. This is really one of the provisions in the Kansas tax cuts that just wreaked havoc on their budget. And that's because what it does is it exempts about 20% or the first 20% at the federal tax changes and the Missouri tax changes exempt the first 20% of income from taxes if it comes from these particular types of business income.
Mm-hmm.
Similar wage earners and people who have salaries do not get that same income right. deduction. So it's fundamentally, you know, unfair. It's prioritizing certain types of income over others. And, you know, what that means is that it's heavily skewed toward the wealthy because those people make more money. And so they have more of an incentive to take advantage of that loophole. But they also have more ability to take advantage of that loophole by restructuring whatever income they have to take advantage of that. So that's why it's really notoriously difficult to estimate how much these loopholes cost, because you can't estimate it based on the current right. number of people who take advantage of
people are gonna change
who file
their,
under that system, because people change the way they structure their income
and,
in order
and
to take advantage of that.
And it's not a set number. Like, we get a $12,000 right. deduction, standard deduction. That's mm-hmm. untaxed income. This is the 20% of however much you make. So
right.
the more money
is
you make,
entirely
the more
untaxed.
Money is untaxed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, and it's not like corporate tax rates in Missouri have been, you know, that was the federal level cut those from 35% to 21%. But Missouri's tax rates on corporations have been low for a long time. Like, what is
that's
the-
right. We've always had, for the past several years, we've had very generous corporate tax rates. In fact, last session, the Missouri legislature again lowered the corporate tax rates. We went from about 6.4% down to 4%. And what that means in comparison to the rest of the nation is we are now the second of those states that do have a corporate tax, we are now the second lowest in the nation.
Wow.
And there are only about, you know, six states that don't have corporate taxes. And many of those collect corporate taxes in other ways. So we really are one of the most generous in the nation.
Wow. so, you know, this is Missouri's doing its own damage to itself with these things. One of the things that I think that people don't – we haven't really spent much time seeing in the media is what's going to be the indirect impacts to states from these massive federal budget deficits that are now – what was $1 trillion this year. I think they're projecting $1 trillion next year because of these tax cuts. A lot of state money – a lot of states' budgets spending comes from the federal government, right? I mean, so – mm-hmm. What's this mean for states next year, the years going looking forward with this kind of federal deficits?
That's right. So it's really a problem for all states, in part because it means that the federal government is less prepared for an economic downturn and is less prepared for challenges that lie ahead, like population aging. But on top of that, particularly in Missouri, because of the changes that we've seen in corporate taxes and other giveaways that have been implemented, we have seen year upon year upon year of cuts in general revenue. Which means that we rely very heavily on federal dollars to pay for many of our programs and services that people care about in Missouri. So any cuts that happen at the federal level will then trickle down to the state level because Missouri is really not prepared to fill that gap if the federal government is not covering those services.
Right. There's no surplus money at the state level. So and what would be some of those programs? So like SNAP.
Right.
Medicaid.
So we really know this is the tax bill was really part of a two-step process.
Right.
So the first step was to, you know, pass the tax cuts, increase the deficit. And then at that point, that gives a motivation to begin to put together cuts in things like Medicaid, SNAP. And really other federal programs kind of across the board, programs that fund child care assistance could be at risk, programs that fund child welfare could be at risk. So it's really, you know, about a third of Missouri's budget comes directly from federal revenue. So that it could be especially problematic here.
Wow. Lindsay, thank you for being on the show. If people want to see more about your research and the research of the Missouri Budget Project, mm-hmm. Into the state, you know, you guys have lots of great information on your website. Where should they go?
So our website is www.mobudget.org. We have all kinds of materials on the website. We also have an e-newsletter that you are able to sign up for. If you go to the front page of the website, www.mobudget.org, you can sign up for that e-newsletter there and get action alerts and updates from us every Friday during session.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the program. This is Lindsay Baker, Research Director for the Missouri Budget Project. You can learn more about it, as she said, at mobudget.org. Stay tuned after the break. I'll be talking with Emily Fetch of the Kansas Center for Economic Growth about that state's attempts to deal with the new federal tax code.
John McCutcheon, in concert on Friday, April the 12th at 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 45th and Walnut in Kansas City. That's John McCutcheon, April the 12th, 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Church. Tickets and information at crosscurrentsculture.org.
Join us on the Local Showcase, Thursday, April 11th, 8 to 10 p.m., a conversation with Cole Younger and Frank James, the historical Wild West. That's Thursday, April 11th, 8 to 10 p.m. on the Local Showcase.
And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. Unlike Missouri, who adjusted their state tax laws last year to alleviate the biggest direct impact to revenues, the loss of the personal exemption, Kansas did not attempt to adjust its state tax laws until this year. Though Kansas's tax laws are considered to be in, quote, rolling conformity with federal law, Senate Bill 22, pushed by conservative Republicans in the legislature and vetoed last week by the Democratic Governor Laura Kelly, attempted to make changes that could have cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars. Joining us now to discuss SB 22 and other impacts of the new federal tax laws on the Kansas budget is Emily Fetch, Director of Policy and Research for the Kansas Center for Economic Growth. Ms. Fetch, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So can you just tell our listeners what are the main provisions of Senate Bill 22 and why have Republicans pushed so hard for it this year?
Yeah, so Senate Bill 22 would have changed the Kansas tax code in response to the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which became law at the end of 2017, as you mentioned. And again, as you mentioned, Kansas is a rolling conformity state, which means that our tax system mirrors the federal one. So what Senate Bill 22 would have done is it would have detached Kansas' tax system from a few of the select federal rules. So not the entire Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but just a couple, kind of cherry-picking a few of the components. And these components that they chose to decouple from would have largely benefited big businesses, multinational corporations, and high-income earners. And in the process, it would have reduced revenue coming into the state. And this is really problematic because Kansas is continuing to rebuild from the brownback tax experiment. And what we need right now is more investment, not a continued loss of revenue.
So this would have been... not a new tax. It would have been actually just new income from corporations bringing their money back to the U.S. And so we were going to implement a new tax on them. They were just going to have to pay the taxes they would owe, right? How much was this going to cost? I mean, how much was this going to bring in that Republicans wanted to just give back?
Yeah. So Senate bill as amended would have cost the state more than $200 million in the first year alone. The corporate tax breaks would have been $137 million of that $200 compared to just $50 million for the individual pieces. Mm-hmm. And over the next 3 years, we would have lost up to $500 million because of this bill.
Wow. And, you know, they already got a tax cut. I mean, they got the federal tax cut. That's why the money's coming back.
Right, yeah, a reduction from 35% to 21%. The Kansas tax rate caps out at 7% for comparison.
Wow. Unlike Missouri, the personal exemption and standard deduction are not tied to the federal levels, but SB 22 would have allowed Kansans who did not itemize on their federal returns to itemize on their Kansas returns. But, you know, the Kansas Department of Revenue is not in the business of auditing and investigating tax deductions, is it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that I think was one of the most interesting things that emerged during the debate about Senate Bill 22. So if Senate Bill 22 would have passed, the Kansas State Department of Revenue would have had to assume responsibilities in areas that were previously covered by the federal government, things like fraud monitoring and deduction verification. And while the bill included more than $800,000 a year to pay for this implementation, another cost, right, for this decision. But it would have, regardless of the implementation, it would have been a significant burden for the Kansas Department of Revenue. They would have had to generate new forms. They would have needed new computer systems to do this kind of work, as well as more staff in order to assume these areas of responsibility that were previously covered by the federal government. And that's not to mention that the bill would have also been retroactive, so there would have likely been an influx of refiled tax returns.
You know, you actually had testified before the legislature with your own ideas about what Kansas should have done, what you think Kansas should do to bring the state rules on deductions and standard deductions and itemized deductions in line more with the federal and actually help working Kansans out. And could you talk about what you proposed?
Absolutely. Before I go into our suggestion about the itemized and standard deduction piece, I also want to say that the Kansas Center for Economic Growth made some suggestions, as you mentioned, about policymakers, what they could do if they really wanted to make changes in tax policy that truly help working Kansans. And so what that looked like was that KCEG urged lawmakers to reinstate the homestead property tax credit for renters, which was eliminated for renters in 2013 during the Brownback years. In addition, we encourage policymakers to bolster the food sales tax credit by making it refundable as well as broadening who is eligible to receive it. And we asked them to view these as kind of alternatives because we know that these are the types of tax credits that actually help low-income working Kansans achieve economic security. But back to your question about the itemized and standard deduction, KCEG did urge policymakers to consider increasing the standard deduction as an alternative to decoupling for the individual income piece. And again, this measure would be more targeted. It would be simpler for taxpayers, tax preparers, and the Kansas Department of Revenue. The problem that I mentioned in terms of kind of having to take over the federal responsibilities in terms of fraud monitoring, all of that, that would not be the case if we adjusted the standard deduction. So it would be much less of a hassle, we think, for everyone involved if they considered the standard deduction piece instead of the itemization.
Yeah, it really struck me as it not a terribly well thought out bill on the Republicans' part. I mean, they offered some sweeteners and related to food sales taxes, but those weren't enough, and they really didn't seem to make a lot of sense in terms of they didn't have a real strategy behind it other than just trying to buy some votes. I mean, what were some of the other proposals that the Republicans threw into the SB 22 to try and get this to pass?
Right. So they threw in two amendments that don't have anything to do with kind of federal tax changes and the conformity. So the Senate passed out the bill, and it just had the conformity pieces. When it got sent to the House Tax Committee, they amended the bill. And they did two things. One, they added a 1% food sales tax reduction. And two, they added a collection mechanism for online sales taxes. And as you mentioned, these sweeteners were intended to kind of make the bill easier to swallow. But the bill, regardless, was still a bad bill. And the two pieces, addressing the high cost of food, Kansas has one of the highest sales taxes on food in the country, as well as considering an internet sales tax. These are things that we want legislators to discuss. These are things that should be debated, but they should be debated on their own terms. These are things that could be their own separate bill, and adding them into a terrible bill didn't make the bill not terrible.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, that bill was already – if that thing had passed, do you have a number for if SB 22 were to pass – if you throw in the losses revenue from the repatriation of foreign profits, the itemized deductions, the tax, the fuel, the food tax cut, sales tax cut, how much would this have cost?
It, again, as amended with the amendment, it would have cost the state more than $200 million in the first year alone. And so the corporate pieces would have been $137 million. The individual conformity pieces would have been $50 million. Over 3 years, the cost would have added up to $500 million.
So much for fiscal responsibility.
Right.
Yeah, so, I want to remind our listeners real quick, this is the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and I'm talking with Emily Fetch from the Kansas Center for Economic Growth about the impact to the state's budget from last year's federal tax changes. One of the particularly troublesome aspects of the new federal tax law is the 20% deduction for sole proprietorships and LLCs, which seems to be modeled after an aspect of the failed Brownback tax experiment that completely excluded all such pass-through income from taxation. I think a lot of Kansas folks are familiar with this story. We discussed how this works a little bit earlier in the show, but can you briefly tell us some of the lessons? This has since been repealed. It was repealed last year, actually, overrode the governor's own veto of it. What were some of the lessons that we've learned from playing around with how we define income and letting some people get off the hook for paying it income taxes this way?
Well, I think that it's really important to note that Art Laffer and Stephen Moore, champions of trickle-down economics, were the architects of the Kansas tax experiment, which was a complete and total failure. And currently, they are serving as advisors to President Trump and helped craft the federal tax changes. And so one of the things that we learned during the Brownback tax experiment is that the administration really underestimated how many LLCs would be exempt, and then related to that, just how much revenue would be lost due to the LLC exemption. And so as a result, Kansas's revenue dropped $700 million in the first year of the tax plan alone. And I'm really worried that this mistake is going to be mirrored at the federal level with the same people advising this tax policy. And Kansas, I mean, in terms of lessons learned, we learned the hard way that we cannot cut our way to prosperity. We had 5 years of economic stagnation. The loss of revenue resulted in 9 rounds of budget cuts, 2 sales tax increases, and 3 credit rating downgrades. And we also learned that Kansans can learn their lessons, right? They rejected this flawed ideology. It took bipartisan support in the legislature to override the governor's veto. And while we're seeing this, unfortunately, pop up again at the federal level, we need our national leaders to make the same realization that Kansas policymakers did and end this damaging tax policy.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that there's really... one of the things that's hard to get your head around with this federal tax, some of these federal tax changes, is exactly what is even their own rationality for why they did it. They can't even give you this argument of, oh, it's going to create jobs or this is better for working people. One of them, for example, we've got some time here, I want to talk about, was this, that the federal tax changes allow for child tax credit for people. Now, they've raised the cap, the income cap on who can claim this, up to incomes of like $400,000 a year to claim this $1,000 tax credit. Meanwhile, poor people got like a $75 bump in the tax credit. You know, you're trying to sit and think, well, you're busting holes in the budget, and what is the justification for people making $400,000 a year getting a $1,000 tax credit for their kid? I mean, there kind of just isn't one. And it seems that this is sort of this stuff with this pass-through income seems to be a similar kind of, this is an ideological argument more than it is any kind of fiscal or even economic argument.
Right. And if they are truly interested in making, child care more affordable, there are more targeted and more effective ways to do that than to extend that credit for such high earners.
Yeah, one of the examples I came across in some research for this was an example of how with these pass-through income exemptions, how even though there are supposedly guardrails in the federal law because I think they tried to impose some guardrails that Kansas did not have, and so this was like, well, we're not going to let doctors do this. There's still salary income they're going to have to count that as. But they pointed out that the way the law is written, it's so unclear that doctors in a medical group could form an LLC, a real estate company, to own the building that they work out of, and then pay exorbitant rent on the building that they would then receive as income through their LLC, and be able to take 20% of that income and not be taxed on it. I mean, it's just simple, that simple of a kind of a maneuver. And this is where I guess accountants are kind of going crazy this year, trying to figure out exactly what all these changes in the laws are going to mean. Do you think SB 22 is now dead? I mean, is it was vetoed. It did pass both houses and it was vetoed. Can it be overridden now? Or is it now too late?
My understanding is that Senate Bill 22 is dead. It's too late to attempt another override. Unfortunately, lawmakers can still try to pass damaging tax policy through other bill vehicles. So the fight's not over. It's really important to stay vigilant and make sure that we work to prevent that from happening when the legislature comes back from recess.
And when do they come back?
They come back May 1st.
And they have until when are they supposed to end the session?
They're supposed to end the session May 17th.
So they have to get a budget passed by from between May 1st and May 17th. You know, how does the budget look at this point? It looks like the school funding numbers there's been a bill passed through both houses has passed the school funding. And it looks to be what Governor Kelly was asking for. Is that true?
Yeah, I think the understanding is that the education bill will address the Supreme Court ruling. Obviously, you don't know until they have had a chance to review it. But it is the plan that Governor Kelly was interested in.
So maybe the school funding thing might finally, at least temporary for a while, get resolved in Kansas. But Medicaid expansion is another big thing, and this kind of goes to some of the other questions that I asked a previous guest about is the indirect effects on state budgets from the federal deficit and cuts to programs like Medicaid, SNAP, Medicare, all these other Social Security, Medicare, those kinds of things. But there are a lot of programs that the states depend on federal government money for. We have now expanded Medicaid in Kansas, although that's currently on the table. Does that look like that's going to happen? And if it does, what's it mean if the federal deficits are $1 trillion going forward?
Well, right now, the leadership in the legislature is making it hard to bring Medicaid expansion to the floor. So I don't know if it's likely. One thing that I would mention, going back to your question of kind of the impact of federal changes, and I think Lindsay from the Missouri Budget Project really spoke to this, but there are definitely going to be implications for states. So when the federal plan was implemented, it was said that it would increase the federal deficit by approximately $1.5 trillion with a T, over the next 10 years. And with that big of a hit, and looking at Trump's proposed budget, there will be cuts to the things that we care about. There will be cuts to investments in education, healthcare, food assistance. I heard you mention SNAP earlier, services for children and the elderly, infrastructure. And these are programs that Kansans depend on, especially right now as our state continues on this kind of path to fiscal stability and responsibility and trying to repair the damage of the brownback years. And for us, not knowing how the federal tax plan is going to impact federal funding for states, it's really more important than ever that Kansas continues to promote responsible and thoughtful tax and budget policy.
And we're going to have to wrap it up right there. We'll be definitely watching those things as we go forward. Emily Fetch, Director of Policy and Research at the Kansas Center for Economic Growth, thank you for being on the show tonight.
Come all of you good workers, this news to you I'll tell. The rights we take for granted now, we have no right to sell. Does anyone?
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, Journeyman Wireman of IBW 124. I'm currently traveling for work as a journeyman, and I would like to share with our non-construction listeners what a hiring hall is and how they work. The hiring hall is one of the oldest and perhaps least appreciated organizing tools available to the labor movement. When operated honestly and efficiently, it is also one of the most powerful tools available to unions in achieving the bargaining strength necessary to win improvements in employees' wages, hours, and working conditions. By controlling access to industry jobs, our members can ultimately control the industry itself and their own destiny. What is a hiring hall? A hiring hall is essentially a meeting place between employers seeking workers and employees seeking work. The hiring hall can be a physical location, such as a union hall, office, a dock, or other gathering place, or a virtual hall consisting of a list of employees and jobs kept in the business agent's head or in a computer. The hiring hall is best described by its function, to match employees and jobs. Anyone can set up a hiring hall, but unions are natural hiring hall operators. In ancient days, skilled craftsmen formed guilds for mutual protection, and interested employers would contact the guilds to secure workers, often on terms set by the guilds. This system provided advantages to both employers and employees, and has persisted to modern times. Even Senator Robert Taft, the father of the infamous anti-union Taft-Hartley Act, believed that employers should be free to seek referrals from unions since the union frequently is the best employment agency. Today, union hiring halls have lots of competition from job contractors and temporary agencies which have sprung up to service employers' growing needs for skilled and unskilled contingent workers. The largest American temp agency, Manpower Incorporated, is one of the nation's largest employers. Yet, Manpower is not much more than a sophisticated for-profit hiring hall, albeit one designed to serve employers' needs only. Types of union hiring halls. Union hiring halls are divided into two kinds, exclusive and non-exclusive. In an exclusive arrangement, the employer grants the union operating the hiring hall the exclusive right to refer employees. The employer cannot hire from any other source. Exclusive hiring halls are almost always established by collective bargaining agreements. The language will state that the union is the sole or exclusive source, or that the union will have first opportunity to refer, etc. If the employer bypasses the hall and hires off the street, the union has a grievance for the lost work. Exclusive hiring halls can also exist without a written agreement as a matter of historical practice of the parties. For example, a theatrical producer who traditionally seeks all of its stagehands from the union-operated hiring hall will be found to have an exclusive arrangement with the union, despite the lack of a written agreement. In such cases, the employer usually pays the workers the union scales published on its rate card. In a non-exclusive arrangement, the union's hiring hall is only one of many possible sources of employees. The employer is not obligated to use the hiring hall, and in fact routinely hires employees off the street. Labor law treats exclusive and non-exclusive hiring halls quite differently. In general, a union has far more legal responsibilities and consequent potential liability in operating an exclusive as opposed to a non-exclusive hiring hall. Of course, there are far more strategic and organizing advantages as well. That was adapted from a piece on the subject by labor attorney Robert S. Giolito. I have some experience with an exclusive system in the form of our local, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124 here in KC. I am now a journeyman wireman, and I do industrial and commercial electrical work downstream from electrical meters, which is not to be confused with working on the distribution lines leading to the meters. When we need a job, we get them through the book system at our hiring hall. We sign the appropriate book, and that serves as our placeholder in line for the next job. When I sign, everyone ahead of me has to be given the opportunity to take a job before I am. When you take a job, you surrender your spot in line. We actually have four books at our hall for journeyman wireman jobs, and jobs have to go through each book before reaching the next one. Book one is for out-of-work journeyman wiremen who are members of IBEW 124. Book two is for out-of-work journeyman wiremen from other local unions who wish to work here. Book 3 is rarely reached, but it is for IBEW members from other classifications, such as linemen, to do wireman work when no wiremen are available. Book 4 is for non-members. I hope our union SIBs and other industries have found this to be an interesting look into how hiring halls work. Have a great evening, everyone.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. The tenant organization that's been forming in to represent tenants is meeting every week on Saturdays at 3 p.m. at 4526 Paseo in Kansas City, Missouri. Cross Border Network is having a tamale dinner with the band Cubanisms Saturday, April 13th at 6 p.m. Go to crossbordernetwork.org for reservations. Workers' Rights Clinic for victims of wage theft and free legal services on wage theft cases. Monday, April 15th, 5 to 8 p.m., El Centro, 7th in Minnesota, in Kansas City, Kansas. Jenny Brown speaks on her book, Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work. Friday, April 19th, 3:30 to 5:30 at UMKC, Hague Hall, Room 301. That's the corner of 52nd and Rock Hill Road. Charlie Hardy, The Cowboy in Caracas. He's back with the truth about what's going on in Venezuela. Monday, April 29th, 7 p.m. at the Joe E. Amayo Community Center, 2810 Metropolitan in Kansas City, Kansas. And the Coalition of Labor Union Women's First Annual Women in Labor Leadership Summit, Saturday, May 4th, 11 to 2 p.m. at IBEW Local 124. 301 East 103rd Terrace in Kansas City. That's it for tonight's show. Be sure to tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to be talking about the Disabilities Integration Act. It could create jobs, and also the attack on Missouri initiatives. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The common man's rights to be in the working class is good enough for me.
This is Jen Zaman, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.